technology provides a novel predictor of human disease. I think, okay, is it? It's okay? Okay, thank you.
Next slide. Well, welcome everybody. My name is Rod Nibby. I'm the senior scientist, and can everybody hear me in the back, or do I need to stand by the mic? Okay. If I start to fade, just raise your hand and I'll move closer to the mic. I'm senior scientist and director of product development at NeoProteomics. I'm going to talk to you today about some systems biology approaches that we have when we engage with clients. Yesterday I went to a translational medicine talk. I forget which track it was in, and when I walked in, the chair of the session was just starting off, and he had a slide up, which got me very excited, because right in the middle of this very busy slide, it said, what do we need more of, doctors or algorithms? Well, I'm a systems biologist with a focus on computational biology, so I got very excited about that. I don't think I ever got the answer to that in that session, but what I'm going to talk to you about today is algorithms. And it's going to be relatively mathematic-free, but the goal here is to get you excited about some of the approaches we have that we can offer you as you further your research. So I'm going to be talking about three algorithms specifically. I'll go over those. These algorithms have been licensed to NeoProteomics by Case Western Reserve University, where the IP was originally developed. And these algorithms form the basis of software we are creating that is the basis for entering into a contractual agreement with a customer to further their research, be they industrial or academic. So we'll get right into it. Traditional biomarker pipelines are sort of characterized by high throughput techniques like proteomics or genomics. You come up with a list of targets. You come up with some statistical measure to rank these targets. And then you parse down the list one by one and you validate them. By contrast, at NeoProteomics, we're organized around networks. So we are network-centric. We see biological organisms as operating according to network interactions rather than simply a list of parts. Our approaches are integrative. That is, we use multiple omic types rather than a single uniomic strategy. And lastly, our result sets are developed as they are developed around networks. They present you with a list of, or a multiplex of, functionally related targets. So we're trying to get at the function of biology with our result sets. Very quickly, we have two broad goals when we engage with a client. One is mechanistic hypothesis generation. So because our result sets are networks, there is inferred interactions in the network, the topology in the network offers opportunities for you to immediately suggest experiments like knockdowns or knock-ins or pharmacological inhibition of certain targets and see how that perturbs the network and then see how that affects your phenotype. So this is really an important step with the network approach. Number two, we are trying to identify and validate companion diagnostics and biomarkers, much like everybody else's, but we're doing it with a multi-omic approach rather than a uniomic approach characterized by, say, just clustering the microarray data. What we've realized in the studies we've published is that networks turn out to be quite powerful features for training classifiers in a variety of contexts, specifically in a cross-validation context, not just leave one out and validate on the same array, but go to an entirely different array of patients, take the targets that we discovered in one array and using one network approach and validate them on another. So this is by no means an exhaustive list of all the multi-integrative approaches over the last 5 to 7 years, but it provides a nice segue to what I'm going to talk to you about today. About 2007, Trey Eidecker's group published a very highly cited paper now, and there's hundreds of citations on this paper, showing that if you combine transcriptomic profiling with a protein-protein interaction network and you perform a greedy search, you can identify little subnetworks within that global protein interaction network that it turned out were better predictors of breast cancer metastasis, either than single gene markers or multi-gene markers, the canonical lists that were published at that time and available. Similarly, Venuno and Chiron show that you could take causal disease genes that you might find by a literature search, combine them with protein interaction, confidence scores. You can read their papers to see how they do that. This drives a global search, again, of a protein interaction network in humans. And you can come up with new novel genes in that disease, And they even inferred protein complexes, which before this study hadn't been known in that disease. Similarly, you can drive a search with linkage analysis and infer positional cloning experiments. So the bottom line of all these approaches is this, that by using the gene expression data in concert with the network information, you arrive at more powerful and robust markers of disease, plus you get mechanism for free, right? Because the result set is a network. It's not just a list of genes. So this got us to thinking in the lab I worked in at Case Western Reserve University. I was working in a model of late-stage colorectal cancer. We were looking for novel markers that would tell us something about the late-stage disease. If you're diagnosed with a late-stage disease, your chances of survival are less than 10% versus an early-stage discovery. So we wanted to characterize that disease, so we obtained 24 tissue samples from patients diagnosed with late-stage colorectal cancer, 12 biopsies with 12 matched controls, separated them by 2D page, did LC-MS/MS on the spots which were significantly changing between test and control, and we came up with about 66 targets, about half down-regulated, half up-regulated in the cancer. And so we wondered if we could, instead of using genomic drivers to seed a search, if we could use proteomic drivers in a network-based search and take advantage of the network information to identify targets in that methodology that were significant for the late-stage phenotype. So we did that. At that time, we were using MetaCore, which is a proprietary protein interaction network. They are now owned by Thomson Reuters. This is similar to IPA for some of those who use that. So let me orient you to the graph. The little proteins you see here with a blue halo around them were found downregulated by the proteomic screen. Those with a red halo were found upregulated by a proteomic screen. We used a guilt by association method to build out the network into a disease association network, again using MetaCore's guilt by association algorithm. We identified about four of these disease associated networks which were significant. So the first thing you need to know when you look at this is we've just made our problem a lot more difficult. Right? We took all these targets that are in blue and red, these few proteomic targets we know are significant for the disease phenotype, we got that from the tissue, and we've expanded it into this graph, which is impossible to use to infer what to do next. The way we used to do it is pick out a part of the network, maybe Western blot for one or two of them, and try to work through the regulatory logic and publish the paper, and then we'd be done. But the real goal is to find out, of all these inferred targets that might be important in the disease, which ones are most important? There wasn't any way to do that. So we invented a method. And this is the first algorithm I'm going to talk to you about. It's something we call SASE. Imagine going to that network I just showed you on the previous graph and taking an arbitrary number of genes represented on that graph. And now let's say you have companion microarray data. In this case, we did from our collaborator. We had 16 controls on a full genome screen along with 50 late-stage tumors that were biopsied. You can imagine taking an arbitrary number of genes on that network and painting it with the gene expression data. Then you can aggregate that gene expression data for that arbitrarily sized network, okay? And you can call that your proxy for network activity. It's a crude measurement, but it actually turns out to work pretty good. So now what I have for each one of these little arbitrary subnetworks is I have an activity pattern for that network in all my control samples and all my tumor samples. I bin the data, I discretize it, and I come up with a score metric. In this case, we use mutual information. What does that allow us to do? That network I showed you two networks ago was quite large. Now I've pruned out all of the noise, all of the genes that were low scoring, and I'm left with just those that are high scorers. Those are indicated in the gray. The other genes are left on the interaction diagram to infer functional importance because they're one hop away from the high scores. Okay, so now I have something to focus on. I can look at this integrin that might be important in the disease, whereas the other interactors with it presumably are not at the level of gene transcription. Here is a integrin binding protein, and there's a couple others that we wanted to look at. So I told you that this is a basis now for going at least to a validation experiment, and that's what we did. We took five of the targets that I showed you on that previous list, and by targeted LC-MS/MS, validated in an independent cohort of patient samples, six, three tumors with three matched controls, that in fact, 12 of the 15 targets were dysregulated at the level of protein. Carbonic anhydrase is shown as a control. Okay, so this is what our model predicted we'd find, and this is in fact what we did find. Last year, we were awarded with a phase one SBIR to commercialize this algorithm and the two I'm going to talk to you about in the next few slides. Most of these algorithms existed as MATLAB prototypes. We're now putting them into a very fancy Java user interface. There's a small footprint GUI up here that allows you to interact with the microarray data. We are data agnostic. This can come from Geo, it can come from your private LIMS system, it can come from proprietary collaborators who haven't published the data yet. We don't care. Wherever your microarray data is, we can import it. We can work with it, normalize it, parameterize the problem, and because this is a computationally intense procedure, we have a scoring engine running under a separate Java VM that the user then can submit their job to. The results come back and they're displayed in a rather fancy GUI. There's a couple of significance tests associated with this. You get a list of genes that are important in your disease. You get the associated heat map with it. Okay. Recently, a researcher at Case Western in the Department of Proteomics and Bioinformatics was interested in candidate drug targets in Alzheimer's. So what he did is went to the literature, found 193 targets significant for Alzheimer's disease. 151 of those mapped to HPRD, which is the curated human reference protein database. This is a global protein-protein interaction network freely available on the net. He then used an algorithm to build out those disease targets into a larger disease-associated subnetwork, and that's what you see over here. He then used SASE, the algorithm I just described to you, along with microarray data, also public, he downloaded from Geo. This was performed on hippocampal tissue, 6 controls with 22 patients of varying severity of Alzheimer's disease. He scored this network using SASE and identified 6 subnetworks highly significant for Alzheimer's disease. Now, the nodes in red are those that he used in his original seed. Those appear in the 151 genes that he mapped. But the green ones are potentially novel. So we're starting to look at those and see what a suitable validation model might be. But there's one more point about those targets. These are the 4 drugs commonly used in the standard treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And while none of the targets of those drugs directly appeared in any of the networks, every single one of them directly interacted with one of those networks. So you're starting to get closer to a hypothesis generation on if we get in the neighborhood of where these disease genes are. And it's well known that the organization of the interactome is not random. We get much closer to inferring experiments on what some of these novel genes and how they may be acting in the disease. Specifically, I'll go back and show this one right here. NAA10 is a gene which encodes an acetyltransferase for a protein called ARD1. ARD1, actually, there was a paper published also at Case Western very recently in Science on Alzheimer's disease showing that RXR, which is a nuclear orphan protein, a nuclear receptor, is critically involved in the transcriptional regulation of APOE, which is, of course, a big player in Alzheimer's disease. I did a little bit of a search on the interactome, and it turns out that this acetyltransferase directly interacts with RXRA. So, again, we're finding targets that are known in the disease. This is typically what we get out of SASE. Targets which are known in other diseases, and potentially novel targets. Now I'm going to move on to and just briefly share with you another algorithm we have, which we're commercializing in the software. If you don't have a commercial package like IPA or Medicore, let's say, perhaps it's too costly, or you realize that there are a couple of drawbacks to those packages. One drawback is that they directly couple their algorithms with their database. So if you have algorithms that you've developed in your lab, your computational biologist, and you want to run it on their database, you're kind of out of luck, unless you want to purchase their database independently, and that's quite expensive. By contrast, if you have a public PPI, say like HPRD or Mint or Intact, and you want to test their algorithms for searching a network on that database, you're also out of luck because they directly couple. So to overcome this in part, we've invented an algorithm which can take any seed. This can be genomic or proteomic. We can seed a random walk of any public or private protein-protein interaction network. Again, we're data agnostic, to discover small subnetworks which are significantly associated with those seed targets that come in. It's sort of a guilt by association algorithm, but it's actually an algorithm based on a variant by Google called the PageRank algorithm. Okay? So we can resolve these networks. We can rank order them, again, by integrating gene expression data, much like we do with SASE, to score them. And this can then drive in silico classification, or it can inform certain wet bench experiments to validate the interactions at the network level. Very quickly, we applied this in a model of metastatic colorectal cancer when we published this work. To make a long story short, we found many subnetworks, about 30, that were highly significant for the metastatic process in colorectal cancer. One that popped out was TCP1. TCP1 is a cytosolic chaperonin complex responsible for folding about 15% of eukaryotic cytosolic proteins. And this popped out as one of the highest scores in the Crane work. It also interacts with an interesting kinase called PLK1. PLK1 is a polo-like kinase responsible for proper assembly of the mitotic spindle. We had found that interesting by previous work as well. So we want to get ahead and validated this. We took four of the most critical subunits of that TCP1 complex, and by Western blot, again in an independent cohort of patient samples, showed that they were in fact upregulated significantly at the level of protein. We also blotted for PLK1 and found it was significantly differentially expressed at the level of protein. At about the same time, I was at the ACR conference in Los Angeles, and Onkova Therapeutics was there letting people know that there was a PLK1 inhibitor now in phase 1 trials for solid tumors. So again, another kind of exciting validation for the approach that we were finding targets which were known or were recently found to be important in the metastatic transformation. I talked to you earlier that you can also use the networks for in silico cross-validation and a classification. Here we used two or three of the networks to train an SVM classifier and then went to another geoset, also in colorectal cancer metastasis, to cross-validate it. The short answer on this is that with just two or three networks, we beat out single gene predictors of the disease. We also beat out, if you download the canonical driver genes in colorectal cancer and use them to classify in a cross-validation context, we even outperform them. Okay, so they turn out to be very good feature trainers for a number of different classifiers in disease. Lastly, I want to talk to you about Crane. The two methods I've described to you so far are based on aggregating the gene expression data. There's a couple of problems with that. If the genes are all down in your controls and the genes you're looking at on the network are all up in the tumors, there's no problem characterizing those. You can find them. Our methods that I showed you, the two methods, will find them. However, that isn't the case with a lot of patients. There's a great deal of heterogeneity in patient data at the level of expression. We all know this. So to give you an example, so those methods would be insensitive to finding the following example. If you have four genes in a network, and here's the expression pattern for those for four patients, for those four genes, here's phenotype, here's control, and I simply aggregate the gene expression data where red is hot and green is cool, well, I get four hot samples and I get four relatively cooler samples. Anybody can classify that. That's not a problem. Aggregate approaches will capture that. However, if I have this network with, say, three genes, and I look, and this is the expression pattern between control and phenotype, then I get this by an aggregate method, and I would lose it. I would simply, that wouldn't score high by mutual information. Wouldn't score high by any metric. So we need another method. So we invented Crane. Crane works on state functions rather than just gene expression data. So we binarize the gene expression data based on the activity of the gene rather than just using the raw expression patterns. So the first application of Crane that we came up with was in glioblastoma. This paper was published in Cancer Cell by another group in 2010, and they had downloaded from the Cancer Genome Atlas 200 patients with glioblastoma expressing one of the four canonical subtypes of that disease. They were unable in this study, they showed some separation on their Kaplan-Meier curves for treatment, but they were not able to show any separation for survival. Okay? But the bottom line of this slide is this. It took them 840 genes of ambiguous biological relevance to classify a subtype of this disease in 200 patients. Now, those of you who are computational biologists, immediately that'll jump out at you as a problem, right? I mean, we have 840 predictors for 200 patients. You want to see that the other way around, generally. So we're looking for parsimonious markers of the disease, not a panel of 140 genes. So we thought CRANE could do better. So what we did is this. We pre-filtered those patients so that any patients that had had previous drug work or therapy that might have influenced the gene expression, we removed from the data set, okay, because we're looking at molecular expression patterns. We then binarized the gene expression data of a public array or of the TCGA array that they worked with, separated the patients into short and long-term survivors, as seen here, and then went down to GEO to get a validation set so that we could validate the results once we made the discovery of our subnetworks. But here's the results. You can see that there's a predictive value for the, for the short-term survivors in red, and in the light lavender, it's for the long-term survivors. Now, it takes about two networks of roughly 10 genes to get 80% predictive value of the long-term survivors. If you go up to five networks of 10 genes, about 50 genes, you can get about 90% classification power in a cross-validation setting with just these five networks. And you can see that the targets in these networks are pretty well interconnected, and there is functional information between these networks as well. Subsequent to publishing this work, we got patients, 16 independent patient samples, and did proteomic validation. We were able to find, by shotgun proteomics, 17 of the 50 targets were detected, the targets here, and 8 were significantly dysregulated at the level of protein, so we've got coverage in each one of these networks. And now the challenge is to go back and sort of focus on those more directly, see what the interaction pattern is, and move the validation to the next step. Okay. These are targets, by the way, which were very unlikely to show up by just clustering data, clustering microarray data alone. It's simply not going to happen. Okay, how much time do I have?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Very, very quickly, a problem I'm working on now with CRANE. A very important clinical problem is colorectal cancer recurrence. Patients who come in with diagnosis of a frank cancer of a mid-stage, say Dukes B or C, Dukes D is late stage, Dukes A is early stage. Many patients who come in with B and C are given the same FOLFOX treatment, be it 1, 2, 3, 5, or 6. Okay? Some of them are disease-free the rest of their life, and they will never die of colorectal cancer. Others are back in the clinic in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the disease has recurred. So it's an important clinical problem to figure out which patients are going to recur versus not, because I will likely give them more aggressive treatment early on. So we wanted to use CRANE to see if we could separate, get a molecular signature that would separate these patients. And so what I did is binarize. I find there's quite a few public arrays that are well annotated for recurrence in GEO. I selected one that has 43 patients who recurred, 40 who didn't. We binarized that gene expression data. We used HPRD as our protein interaction network. And then we did one more step. We followed CRANE, the networks, with a little method called a set cover approach. Set cover is just a fancy way of saying how many of these networks does it take to cover the samples? That is, how many of the patients actually express these networks? Okay, and then the idea is to separate them and look at those networks and see what's going on. So very briefly, what I did is CRANE can predict either recurs or non-recurs. When I predict recurs on the discovery set, I can cover about 90% of the patient samples with only five networks. There were 25 that CRANE discovered. Networks is on the x-axis, patients are on the y-axis, annotated accordingly. The little green dots indicate that the network is uniquely expressed by that patient sample. So in only five networks, I can cover about 90% of the patients. Same with the recurs on the discovery set. Slightly under 10 networks, I can cover 90%. Notice there's no green up here or up here, which means that there are no false positives in this method. There's just a few over here, and I would argue that those patients that actually express the non-recur network are probably mislabeled. We don't know that for sure, but that's a hypothesis. If I validate that, this group actually ran on the same hardware, a completely different set of patients 10 years later. If I validate that, the news is so-so. 95% I can cover about 95% of those independent patients with 25 networks, but some of the recurrers also express the network. So the classification power drops a little bit in a cross-validation setting, and we're working on this. What's really interesting is if you look at the networks. As a computational success, I'll tell you that these are the top scoring five or six networks by Crane when we predict non-recurrence. Green means the protein is on, white means it's off. But these are not isolated networks in the interactome. They are not all over the place. It actually turns out that they have a fair amount of overlap, and the second one here has a hub protein called CERC, which I'm sure you're all familiar with as an oncogene in a number of tumors. What's really interesting, however, is that you would think if a gene is on in the non-recurs, it ought to be off in the recurs. Computationally, that's what we'd expect. That's exactly what we find. Five of the genes that are on in the recurs are actually off here. So these are really interesting genes, because if the gene is on, it looks like maybe you have a preselection for recurrence. If the gene is off in the network, then maybe you don't. And there's a lot of overlap even in the recur networks that we're finding with Crane. So we're really excited about this particular algorithm, and it's the next one we have slated for integration. So conclusions, we are a company, integrative network biology drives biomarker and companion diagnostic discovery, and this can be important in drug discovery as well. Robust multiplex networks will advance mechanistic validation, so if that's your goal, our service engagement with you can accomplish that as well, and we can show you approaches that we have used for cross-validation to improve the validation of your biomarkers. We are developing these algorithms and other into a robust suite of network algorithms, which we hope will actually be a portal for the best of breed down the road. We're working on getting additional funding for that. This will be flexible, supported software products at a reasonable price, which we right now are engaging customers with in a software as service model, rather than selling them as tools outright. And with that, I'll take questions. I want to thank the funding, both for NeoProteomic support, for the grants we've received, Sanford Markowitz Lab for providing the samples, John Schenkel, the president of NeoProteomics, Mark Chance, my mentor when I was getting my PhD, and others in the Center for Proteomics and Bioinformatics.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Nidhi, for your good talk. I think we have the time for one question.
Thank you.
Right. So, let me move to the luncheon presentation.